The John Deere Right to Repair FTC settlement is a story I've been watching develop for years, and it's worth explaining why this particular settlement matters and why it's taken this long to arrive. John Deere sells agricultural equipment, tractors, combines, planters, that modern farmers depend on entirely. Over the past decade, that equipment has become deeply computerized. The engines are controlled by software. The diagnostics run through proprietary systems, and crucially, when something breaks, you cannot repair it without access to John Deere's diagnostic software, which the company has historically restricted to its authorized dealer network.
And the practical consequence is that a farmer with a $500,000 combine that breaks down during a 72-hour harvest window can't fix it themselves, can't take it to an independent mechanic, and has to wait for a John Deere authorized dealer who might be hours away and booked out to come diagnose the problem. The equipment that farmers own physically, they don't fully control functionally. That's the core of the right to repair argument.
The FTC settlement requires John Deere to provide farmers and independent repair shops with access to the diagnostic software, service manuals, and tools necessary to perform repairs. It's a consent order, which means John Deere agreed to it rather than being found liable after a trial. The HN thread has 279 comments and is a mix of farmers sharing direct experience with this exact problem, software engineers debating the technical architecture of the restrictions, and policy people arguing about whether consent orders actually get enforced effectively.
This is a good place for our curriculum corner, Marcus, because the word antitrust has been thrown around in the HN comments on the Deere story. And I think it's worth being precise about what antitrust actually means and how it applies here.
Walk us through it.
Antitrust law in the United States rests on three main pillars, the most important being the Sherman Act of 1890. Section 1 prohibits contracts, combinations, or conspiracies in restraint of trade. Section 2 prohibits monopolization, which is distinct from simply being large or dominant. Here's the thing that most people get wrong. Having a monopoly isn't illegal. Being a monopoly and abusing that position to harm competition is what the law targets. The legal test isn't just what percentage of the market do you have. It's whether you acquired or maintained that market power through exclusionary conduct rather than through superior products, efficiency, or historical accident. John Deere isn't being pursued for being big. The argument is that restricting access to diagnostic tools is a form of exclusionary conduct in the aftermarket for repair services. They're using their dominant position in the equipment market to monopolize a related market in servicing those machines. Think of it like a printer manufacturer that sells printers cheaply, but then restricts ink to only their cartridges. The printer market might be competitive, but they've created a captured aftermarket. Courts have been inconsistent on when that crosses the line, which is why the FTC chose a consent order rather than litigation. It gives them the outcome without having to prove the legal theory.
That's a genuinely important distinction. And it applies in a lot of the tech contexts we discuss. When we talk about Apple's App Store policies or Google's search practices, the legal question isn't, are they big? It's, did they use that size to prevent competition from emerging through means other than just being better?
Exactly. And the Deere case is actually relatively clean by those standards. There's a clear aftermarket, clear exclusionary conduct, and clear harm to competitors who would provide repair services.
The ambulance pricing story connects to some related market structure thinking. The piece in today's feed examines why American ambulance rides are extraordinarily expensive compared to peer countries, sometimes $3,000 to $4,000 for a basic transport, and the explanation involves several layers. Ambulance services in the U.S. are frequently operated by private companies in geographic markets where they hold exclusive contracts with municipalities. You don't choose your ambulance when you're having a medical emergency. It's dispatched, and you pay whatever it costs.
The HN thread on this one is 312 comments and has genuine heat, personal stories of massive bills, debates about insurance coverage gaps, comparisons to other countries' municipal ambulance services. What strikes me about the discussion is how many people describe the cost discovery as coming weeks after the emergency, which means there's no moment where a patient can make an informed cost decision. The market structure here is almost perfectly designed to prevent price competition from functioning.
Now, the solo developer train simulator story is something I want to dwell on for a moment, because it represents a type of story that gets a specific and genuine response from the HN community. One person building something that outperforms commercial studios with teams of dozens or hundreds, that's a story about what dedicated individual craftsmanship can achieve. Kotaku called it the best train simulator ever made. The HN community has 242 comments worth of genuine enthusiasm for this.
What I find interesting in the thread is the conversation about the specific advantages of solo development. No design by committee, no feature bloat driven by product management, no compromises between engineering and business requirements. The developer presumably built exactly what they thought a train simulator should be, with deep domain knowledge and relentless focus, without having to justify decisions to stakeholders. There's also a long and interesting HN discussion about which categories of software are most amenable to solo development versus which genuinely require teams.
The 3D Realms and Apogee Retrospective fits in this theme. That's a piece written in 2020 by someone who was there during the shareware era, when small teams and sometimes individuals were making games that defined the medium. The HN community has a reverence for that period of software history and a reflexive interest in stories of individual creators doing things people assumed required large organizations.